Hello and welcome to Watch the Throne. What a lovely day. This is episode 37, A Million Ways to Die in the West from 2014. I'm Joey Lewandowski.
And I'm Mike Manzi.
And with us today, we have back from, I should have looked this up before, back from Reindeer Games. Here he is, all the way back from playing Rudy with, you know, the powwow safe, wherever that movie took place. We've got Dan Hayden. Hello, Dan.
Hi, how you going, Joey, Mike? Nice to see you guys.
Things are good. Good to have you back. So, Mike, we got to a point I didn't think we were going to get to. We got to the most ego-fueled Charlize Theron movie since a Woody Allen movie.
It is crazy. I mean, I didn't think anyone could do that more than Woody Allen, to be honest with you. But here we are with Seth MacFarlane, who wrote a movie just so he could kiss Charlize Theron. Or at least that's how it feels.
It's a lot. I saw this movie in theaters somehow.
Really?
And I don't know how I sat through it in theaters without like blowing my brains out or walking out of the theater, because it's long, not very funny. Like, let me preface this by saying I think Seth MacFarlane is incredibly talented. Like, I am in awe of his talent in a lot of ways. As a leading actor in this movie, not even a little bit. Mm-hmm. Like, I think he's an incredible musician for, you know, whenever he does like the stuff like when he's watched Family Guy or like his, like, you know, his award hosting stuff, the type of humor, it's not exactly for me, but I think he knows his audience and it's great for that. Like, I am really impressed by a lot of what he does. And yet I cannot stand this movie.
Yeah, I couldn't quite put my finger on what he was trying to accomplish aside from, making out with Charlize Theron. It seems like it's a lot of jumbled up little one raunchy joke here, little sight gag here. The entire thing's just a huge, strange, if a modern day guy would have a commentary on, you know, the 1880s West.
Well, that's the thing. Like, it's like a live-action cartoon almost, like an episode of Family Guy in the West. And I almost feel like if this was animated, it could have fixed, like, a lot of its issues. Like, just because of its live-action nature, I don't feel like a lot
of
these...
Well, I like that, yeah.
I don't feel like a lot of these jokes land, like, especially the physical ones. But, you know, this isn't Blazing Saddles. I think he was kind of trying to go for that, but his sensibilities are a little different, and it's weird. This feels like a romantic comedy stuck back in the West, but it feels as if, like, the Seth MacFarlane character was, like, from today, so he's, like, lost in time or something, and, like, just do that, because, like, we have a shout-out to Back to the Future anyway with the Doc Brown cameo. Just, you know, make that the storyline or something. I don't care. But it's just not gelling here. I am also sort of with you, Joey. Like, I think the guy's got tremendous talent. Like, I was just more of a Simpsons fan when The Family Guy came out, so people were sort of taking sides back in the day. But I've sort of grown to like American Guy a lot, and I really like his variety show stuff that he did, like one or two of those big old-school specials where, like you said, like he comes out and he sings and dances. He's almost got like a very good sort of crooning voice to him, almost like Sinatra-esque, dare I say. But he is not a leading man whatsoever. Like, this is just not his forte. He doesn't even look or feel comfortable to me on screen when he's on in front of the camera. So I'm kind of surprised that he even decided to play the lead here. Like, we saw him in Soderbergh recently, right, as just sort of like a little walk-on role,
but that was great because he was in character.
Exactly.
Like, this is just him as him.
That's the problem.
The most jarring thing to me in this movie is that they speak with no accent, aside from Liam Neeson, who apparently was just willing to do this movie if, like, he was allowed to do, like, the whatever accent he wanted to do. And Seth MacFarlane's like, yeah, sure, whatever. But, like, they speak with whatever accent they want, just normal stuff. They use modern-day parlance, which I guess works. If it works for you, that's great. But for me, I was just like, he and Charlize Theron just talking, like, as though it's 2015 or 2014 or whatever this movie came out, but just, like, in 1882 in Arizona. I'm just like, this just feels weird. Like, it feels like he's trying to write, like, this, like, love letter of sorts to the Old West and doesn't want to get, like, little, like, he gets so many little details right, and then just, like, that feels so incorrect, intentionally so, and I don't know why. I don't know why it's like that.
Yeah, it took a while for me to, you know, remember that this is, like, you know, supposed to be, like, an Old West movie, because, the way everyone's talking just kind of throws it off a little bit. And it's funny, you mentioned that, like, this could have been better done as an animated movie. How do you think this movie could have possibly gone better if it was like in a in a Family Guy form, you think, or something like that?
Well, I feel like it already is for the most part. I mean, the way that jokes are told and set up, or there's a lot of things that just feel like cutaways, you know, or like, I mean, it's not like he even says like, hey, remember the time, and then they cut to it or anything, but a lot of, I feel like the humor feels very much like not really derived from like the story per se, but just like the concept, like, oh, the Old West can be hilarious, like, you know, they used to shit in outhouses, so like we could do a lot of that kind of humor, and you know, we can just say like horse shit, and like, no, I mean, look out for the horse shit, you know, like, yeah, that kind of stuff. Like, I don't really feel like the comedy is naturally inherent to the plot in very many ways. Like, it is from time to time, just because it will be, and they'll hit those jokes, but the majority, I feel, of the humor is a lot of this sort of not the non sequitur stuff, or like just the things that are observational humor from the character's perspective. So I just feel like ultimately if it was animated, it would just feel closer to that type of branding, I guess, you know?
Yeah, like the freaking photo joke. The joke about not smiling, yeah, in the photos. Yeah. Did it really need four references?
Yeah.
I just don't think the movie just seemed very cohesive to me. It seemed very much rushed. I have this idea of making this Western movie where at the end of the movie, I shoot a guy and I get a girl and a new perspective on life, because I'm not with like this shallow person that hates me. Just, you're right, it is a romantic comedy. It's completely a romantic comedy.
And that's what's so weird, because if he wouldn't have, because he's Seth MacFarlane, but if he had just made that Western and not this comedy, like, I haven't really seen that before, the idea of a romantic comedy taken seriously in the Old West, and that stuff could work on its own, but he's just not really focused on that in this movie. It's just more about trying to get people laugh scene to scene, as opposed to like really get any kind of like solid story going. And because like even the end when he shoots with the poison bullet, like, that's cool, like, okay, but this guy hasn't really, this, it hasn't been that movie up until this point, so even that moment isn't feel like it is rewarded.
And like, to get to that point of sit around a campfire and hear people talk Mila Kunis for a while, be like, okay, that's just what this movie is. You know what I mean? Like, it's just, it feels all over the place. I had this sort of same sort of criticism when I saw Chef, but I like Chef as a movie, so I'm able to overlook it. But I feel like for me, Chef is the kind of movie that Jon Favreau wrote because he's like, look, I want to be in a movie where Scarlett Johansson and Sofia Vergara, Olivia Wilde, no, maybe not. Who else is in that movie? Sofia Vergara and like two or three different women who are like either all loved me or all like, this feels like a kind of movie where he's like, let's start a movie where I'm dating Amanda Seyfried, beautiful, and then we break up and I'm heartbroken, but then I get an even better, even hotter woman. And it's a movie where Charlize Theron is going to tell me how great I am, where I get to kiss her in the end. And I know that's not, I'm assuming, what happened, but it just feels like, let's have a movie where like I can get an ego boost from these beautiful actresses that everybody loves and just let them have fun. Like, I can totally see why she would do this movie. Like, if this is her kind of humor, if, you know, she wants to make a movie in the Old West, if whatever. Like, I can see a lot of reasons why, but I also see more so reasons why he would want to make this movie and cast her in it. I'm jealous, I guess, is the bottom line.
Yeah, no, I hear you. I mean, I could totally see why she would want to do this movie. It almost feels written for her too. Basically, like, he's just constantly complimenting her character on like her looks or her intelligence or her abilities and all this things. And like, that's cool. That's great that and she genuinely is that type of character. Like, she's beautiful, she's smart, like, she's cunning, she's, you know, all these things. I think the issue is that like he's constantly reminding, like, that's all he's really talking about. It's like, okay, I could see it. She can speak for herself, but I also can see like what her character gets to do is kind of fun as well when she's not just playing like the wingman kind of stuff. Like, that kind of bothers me, but I do like the way that she, like, I do like her comic timing. I do think she has comic timing. Like, I think she's good at comedy. I just wish she was doing better comedy and more comedies and all that kind of stuff, because she could really throw herself into this kind of stuff and make it work and everything. So, like, at least she's performing well.
Yeah, she's the best part of the movie character-wise. Yeah, she's not, like, the best-written character, but what they gave her to work with, she achieves.
Yeah, I just think of the way she delivered all that stuff about being married at 9 but not having sex till she was 10. Oh, I'm rounding it up and everything. Like, that's
It was late 9, I'm rounding up.
Yeah, like, that's not my... Like, that's kind of dumb gross humor and stuff, but like she got through and she pulled it off. I feel like she did it better than other people would have in the way that she like was reacting about it.
Well, like, I mean, I think we know by now that she is incredibly charming and a great actress and can deliver whatever. Like, we haven't really seen her be bad in many, if any, movies. Like, I'm trying to think. She's able to sell whatever you give her, just, I agree with you, Mike, like, give her better stuff. I'm glad you brought up the wingman stuff, because I wrote, she's, like, the best wingman or wingwoman in, like, the history of movies. Like, she is just, let me make this girl super jealous of you. Oh, and by the way, like, I'm going to be such a good wingman, wingwoman, I'm just going to date you at the end.
Yeah, it's crazy, because before I saw this movie, I was outlining a script in school called The Wing Girl, and it was basically, like, the idea that this best friend helped her guy friend try and get a girl back, but then they ended up falling for each other at the end. So it's basically this movie, but in modern day, without any of the sick humor.
In terms of Charlize Theron, because there's not a lot to talk about in this movie, because I can think we can skip a lot of it, but in terms of Charlize Theron, she rides into town, and it looks like she's just part of Liam Neeson's posse, who is basically playing Clint Eastwood. What's his name? Like, Clutch Leatherwood? Clinch Leatherwood?
Clinch
yeah. Leatherwood. And she, it looks like she's just part of her, are part of his posse. Then we find out that she's married to him, but she seems like tired and resentful and not so thrilled to be with him anymore. In that opening scene, what I really, really liked was where she was like saying how quote-unquote lucky she was to be married to him, and she's just like in the most dry, deadpan way, oh my god, I love you, I'm like the luckiest girl ever in the history of girls. Like, she's able to like inject this character, which I think is, it feels like a lot of these characters are sort of generic Western tropes on purpose, with, you know, a little bit of flair. Like, we have this here, we have Neil Patrick Harris in a really great role, if only because of what he brings to it, I think. But like, everything sort of feels like a cliche, which I get and which I'm okay with. And I just like this, you know, outlaw's bride who is tired of the outlaw, but she's able to bring these like little bits of life to the character. He sends her off. What happens?
Okay.
He's like,
yeah.
Go into town because I need you to be safe. I'm going to come back later. Like, I don't remember. I didn't write it down for some reason.
Yeah.
Why does she get separated from Clinch?
Clinch is taking like a majority of the gang and going to like scout ahead and lay low. Her and his other little henchman guy are supposed to just go to the town, also lay low, while they have like a bunch of gold or something they're trying to hide.
Yeah, that's it. On the dusty trail, they run into the old prospector, and speaking of cliches, Joey, like, yeah, we get the guy like, I got my gold, and they take it, yeah, and that's when you find out that Clinch always shoots on two instead of three,
yes,
and you also get the sense that Charlize is, yeah, like you said, like, isn't an outlaw, just sort of, like, entangled with him, because she's like, just let him go, and he's like, I'm gonna kill him for fun. So they're about to go, I think, up to the gold site. Yeah, Charlize and her, they say it's her brother, I just figured, what the hell, might as well be her brother. And they go to town, right, to sort of like, I guess, get a place ready for them so that they could all come back with the gold and posse up. But it's not exactly clear. I don't think Seth really cares about this little thing. It's like, she should have just wandered into town one day and you could have just cut all that other stuff out.
I guess you have to set up the fact that she's with him to sort of give the end more stakes, or give, like, because if she's just like a girl, right, that just comes into town, whatever, like, that you don't really know that she's, I don't know, like, I feel like, I don't have a problem with the setup, it just sort of, it's just kind of whatever. Like, you have to get her to town with, like, the history of, like, a shady backstory, essentially.
Yeah, it's very fast and loose.
But it's strange, like, you're saying, yeah, she's got to have some kind of relationship with the guy. I find it strange that at the end of the movie, Liam Neeson is threatening to shoot his own wife if Albert doesn't come and face him.
There's a lot of really loose writing in this too, because the movie opens with Seth MacFarlane at a duel and he's like, how about I come by Sunday and pay you off? You never see it, but later in the movie it just kind of like drops a line to Giovanni Ribisi. Him and Sarah are like my second favorite part of this movie, but he drops a line where he's like, I even went by that guy's house and paid him off, you know, so he wouldn't kill me. It's like, dude, you're just sort of dropping threads and they're supposed to be jokes, but it feels like they're supposed to be integral parts of the plot, and when they wind up not being, the movie feels like it's filled with holes.
Yeah.
What makes Blazing Saddles so great is it's about race. You know what I'm saying? Like, that first and foremost, like the idea of the African-American sheriff coming into town in the Old West and taking over and teaming up with like the old white gunslinger, and they're going to fight apartheid. And it's great. And the jokes really stem from that. It's because at the time, and even today, maybe even more so, it's a really strong issue. And I think here, everything hinges on the idea that, oh, I'm a guy from today, but I'm stuck then. And so I talk like today and I make observations like Seinfeld, but like no one around me understands them because they're not from today and they're not acting. So, you know, like I feel like the joke that this hinges on isn't strong enough to carry the movie in a way that something like Blazing Saddles is. Because then in Blazing Saddles, you can just sort of like do non sequitur things like, hey, Count Basie and his orchestra, you know, like out in the middle of the desert actually playing the music. And it's funny and it's fun. But if you do that in this movie, it doesn't feel like it belongs.
Blazing Saddles is a fantastic movie. It's really hard to put this movie up against that. That's probably one of the first semi-adult comedies that I saw ever. And it's still one of my more favorite comedy movies. So trying to hold that to up to this one is a little difficult.
No, but I mean just in the sense that it's the only other movie like it.
Yeah.
Like it's a Western comedy. I really stress hard to think of another one. Maybe I think Christopher Guest made one about Lewis and Clark. But yeah, it's just not a common thing.
Wait, did Christopher Guest do one about Lewis and Clark?
He did one. I don't know if it was the Lewis and Clark one, or I think maybe it was the one with John Candy, but if I'm not mistaken...
Was it Wagons East?
It could have been Wagons East. I think that was the Lewis and Clark one, though. I don't know. I digress, I guess.
Almost Heroes?
Okay.
Is that the one where it's the real guys who did it, but they kind of get walked over by Lewis and Clark?
Yes.
Okay.
That is, I never saw this one. We were just talking about Christopher Guest recently. This is one that I didn't see. This must be the only one. This is Matthew Perry and Chris Farley.
Okay, that's it. Yeah, I think that's the one.
Chris Farley's last leading film role was released following his death in 97. Speaking of Christopher Guest, I wish they were in it more. They were only the one shot, but Fred Armisen and John Michael Higgins as like the town gay couple, I guess? Just like in that bar? Like, I love that. Like, I want more of those. Like, I want the weirdo town people. The less time we spend with Seth MacFarlane, the better. I want more time with Neil Patrick Harris and Amanda Seyfried. I want more time with Giovanni Ribisi and Sarah Silverman. I want more time with Fred Armisen and John Michael Higgins. And more time with Charlize Theron, of course. But like, I just feel like I don't want time with Seth MacFarlane. And this movie, like for a two-hour runtime, is with him for probably an hour 45 or more.
Why couldn't he just be the bartender? Like, that feels like the perfect role for him, too. In Westerns, like, that can be a very sort of central social gathering point, you know, the saloon and everything. And so, like, he could be in a lot of the movie and give all this stupid advice and crack dumb jokes and be smart, snarky, and everything like that that he wants to be. But we could get it in doses. And then we could have maybe put, you know, Giovanni Ribisi in his role or someone. You know, I would like to have seen Jake Gyllenhaal play his role. Like, I thought that would have been hilarious. I mean, if you've seen even 10 minutes of The Boy in the Bubble, or was it Bubble Boy? One was Travolta. Okay. Like, he can really swing for the fences, and like I would like to see him do some more comedy, and this feels like something he could have pulled off.
People give Tarantino a lot of shit for like putting himself in movies and giving him big parts, you know, whether he's Jimmy or whether he's the bartender, not big parts, but like parts like Jimmy in Pulp Fiction or the bartender in Death Proof, but like he's not casting himself as the lead in these movies. Like, I agree with you, like put him as the bartender, put him as like any number of roles. I feel like I'm beating a dead horse, or I don't want to keep just ragging on it, but like it's just a bummer, man.
Yeah, making him the sheep farmer, just so for the sake of giving Neil Patrick Harris a name to call him and a couple of sight gags. And I guess maybe when Liam Neeson's like coming for him to kill him and he's like hiding out in like the herd. And of course the very last shot of the movie where they have like a billion sheep. Like, what was the point of making him a sheep farmer? Yeah, I feel like they could have done a lot more by just giving him a different occupation. Like you said, just making him a bartender or something could have lent itself way better to the script.
I feel like him being a sheep farmer is the joke. You herd sheep and stuff, but like you grow stuff on a farm, and I guess you usually have cows and horses and things, so like he's an idiot because he has sheep. Ha ha ha. Like, that's the joke. I feel like you get the same sort of joke with his parents, right? And I think halfway through the movie, his mom dies, but we don't see it. Because in the beginning of the movie, there's two of them sitting in the chair, and at the end, there's just one of them, and there's like a common. Anyway, so like that's you know, he's just not concerned with continuity when he doesn't want to be, when it's not funny to him, I guess. But yeah, the sheep thing, you know, it was funny once or twice when like they followed him into town and he like called him by name and told him to go home. I was like, that's kind of funny, but not funny enough to the extent in which they stick with this joke. Because
one of my favorite little like throwaway gags or whatever in this movie about the sheep is like when he's like, you haven't been shearing your sheep, and then that sheep that's just like a ball of fluff like runs headfirst into the wall. Like, I like stuff like that. Like, that works. I mean, I don't think you can really necessarily build an entire movie on that, but just like I enjoy some of the stuff. It's just the things they choose to focus on is just ooh boy, okay. A couple of little observations about this movie, because I don't know how much more we can actually talk about it. I like, it's also, of course, Charlize Theron can roll a better cigarette than Seth MacFarlane. Of course, she's in a movie where she just likes to eat pot cookies, because we know about her. She loves to smoke weed, or I don't know if she still does, but she has in the past. And she also used to smoke cigarettes, like we were talking about on Prometheus. She was having a hard time on that movie because she had to run across land in that really, really heavy bodysuit and was weighed down. Like, she like couldn't catch her breath because of all the cigarettes she was smoking. I just like that, like, he's such a nerd in this movie that this, like, outsider, this, like, cool, badass outlaw is better than that kind of stuff. But I also just like that it's kind of bringing a little bit of her, in a way, to this role.
Yeah, I was really surprised to find out over the course of Watch the Throne what a pot enthusiast she's been and has been. And I guess even if she doesn't still partake, like, she's in that movie Gringo, which is about weed pills and stuff, so she's still, like, on the side of the stoners and everything. Okay, I like it. It's always funny when, you know, people get high on camera and stuff, but two things about that pot scene. Like, were there pot cookies back then? Like, could that have even been possible?
Would they have called them pot cookies?
Right, yeah. Wouldn't it have been, like, marijuana cookies or cannabis cookies or whatever, or, like, I don't know, some derogatory term for people. And the other thing is, like, they don't sit with that scene once he's high. Like, there's another scene later where he trips with the Native Americans and goes on, like, a spirit quest, if you want to call it that. I don't care. I was expecting the joke to be, look how dumb he is when he's high. He's going to, like, embarrass himself or do something stupid. Maybe, like, you know, pull his pants down or something. But, like, they basically just cut away after a beautiful looking sunset, so I didn't know what the joke was.
Funny you mentioned the sunset. I actually found some of the shots of this movie to be beautiful.
This movie is gorgeous.
Yeah.
That pisses me off too. Like, it looks better than some of those classic westerns at time, and it's just because when you're shooting down in Monument Valley, wherever you point the camera, you're gonna get an amazing shot.
Yep.
So not only the look, but the score at times, I'm like, this score, how much did he spend? He must have spent everything on that score, because it sounds like a top of the line John Williams, belongs in a Spielberg movie type score. And, like, those things were just bothering me too, because it's like, be in better movies.
Yeah, I went into this movie, I saw it in theaters, and I didn't look at any reviews because it looked funny to me. And
yep.
I was actually very optimistic from the opening of the movie. It was like an old spaghetti western opening with the shots and the overture and the credits, and I was like, hey, maybe this actually will be, you know, something interesting and good. And of course, you know, from what we're talking about, that's not the case. But the beginning, and then, like, the horse chase near the end of the movie, some parts of the montage when she's teaching him to shoot, just, like, some really gorgeous shots.
Yeah, that montage was the worst. Like, they're just, like, how, like, I can't believe.
I actually kind of like that.
Was that the joke, though? Like, that we're target practicing is, like, because it's the most obvious idea for a montage or something? Or, I don't know.
I like the montage because it feels like in a lot of other movies, people get really good really fast. Like, I mean, in Rocky movies, and that's obviously what they're going for in the Rocky movies. Like, hey, let's show him getting ready to fight Drago in the snow. Here, it's like, what I liked about it is that it's a montage where he doesn't really get better. Like, it's such incremental progress over what feels like forever. You know what I mean?
Okay,
and I like that twist on it. I don't know if it's, like, interesting or engaging to watch, but once I sort of realized what I think they might be going for, I was like, oh, I kind of like that, that this guy is so bad at everything, really, that, like, he can't even get, like, the historic, you know, you do the montage and, like, he can't hit anything, and then by the end, he's, like, dual-wielding and, like, doing what Charlize does at the fair. But here, you know, he's just getting, like, incrementally better. Like, he's just barely better, but he's just barely better enough so he can shoot Liam Neeson with the poison bullet and hit him and then, you know, poison him that way. So, like, I like the idea of it. I don't know if it's done in the most effective way, but at least in my brain, I was like, oh, that's kind of unique and kind of like a twist on what you normally would see in this movie.
No, that is. That is actually very funny, and I'm upset that I didn't get that joke in the movie, you know, because I guess I thought the joke was the montage, not the content of the montage, and that by the end, he wasn't a great quick draw, but, like, he was able to shoot part of one can or something like that. Like, I guess that just kind of, it washed over me, this viewing. Even at the end, when he just nicks Liam Neeson, and that's all he needed to do was get good enough just to barely, like, hit somebody. Like, it was all totally lost on me this time. But I do like that idea and that concept.
Not only does he just kill him by just nicking him, he takes the time to say the name of the movie while he does it.
Well, he says the name like 3 or 4 times. He's like, there's a million ways to die in the West. Just walk outside. There's our mayor. He's been dead for 5 days. The block of ice that falls and all that kind of thing. So, yeah, titular line all over this place.
You know, every time we see a really weird, crazy death, like the ice scene or like everything at the fair, it just reminds me that I wished we had, like, way more of it. I know it's an easy joke to make, and like I was saying before we started recording, like, all the jokes on Letterboxd seem to be like, oh, that's not actually about a million ways to die in the West or whatever. I wish, like, there are so many other things you could do, like, even just as, like, interstitials between scenes, you know what I mean? Just, mm-hmm. like, have, like, a snake bite somebody. Like, even, like, just, like, sort of basic stuff. Like, if you just really rack up the body count, like, you do, like, a comedy in the Old West, but you have, like, 100 people die on screen in just, like, wildly different ways. Like, even if it's just not super creative, like, have, like, because everything in here is pretty funny and creative, but just do way more of it.
Yeah, the fair, you know, the whole run and get, oh, people die at the fair. People are dying left and right at the fair. If they did that throughout the whole movie, you're right. Maybe it would have been, I don't know if it would have made the movie necessarily better, but maybe it just would have helped for the namesake.
It would have been a great running gag, too, if there a lot of it just happens in the background, sort of like off focus or something, like offset, you know what I'm saying? So like they're talking in the foreground and then you just see someone like fall off a cliff or something, or like their carriage go out of control and like run into the building or something like that. And yeah, I agree with that wholeheartedly. Like that's a great way to sort of end a scene too. Like, you know, the characters walk off screen, like, okay, let's go, and they walk off screen and we linger, and then you see, you know, someone get trampled by a horse or something, I don't know, but ramp that stuff up, have it playing a lot more, running in the background, and then by the end of the movie, you know, the viewer is sort of privy to more than the characters on screen, and it gives you a nice feeling at the end. You're like, oh my gosh, like, I've seen all this stuff going on in the background that these guys haven't even been paying attention to.
It would have been just a little bit higher of a body count, because yes, I counted. You only, besides like the mayor's corpse, you only witness 12 people die, and that's including the little extra scene at the end where Django shows up.
So apparently they added Django because test audiences, and rightfully so, reacted so poorly to the first shooting scene where like they're just shooting little black tin statues or whatever. They added Django in to be like, hey, no, like we're not trying to shoot black people or whatever. Like we're gonna have, you know, this gunslinger that everybody knows from the West. Like, haha, everything's okay, right? But I do like that they added him. You know what I mean? Like, even if it was just like a reflexive or reactive thing to make sure that like the movie didn't come off racist, I like that he's there at the end, because it's the kind of thing, like you were saying earlier, Mike, with Doc Brown, why not do more of that? Like, if you're gonna do it like a couple times, why not do it a bunch?
They had some really good cameos that I feel just kind of were wasted. I would have liked him to talk more to, like, the talking sheep Patrick Stewart. Or, not that I think that Gilbert Godfrey's amazing, but maybe
oh,
run with...
Oh, he's a great Abraham Lincoln, though.
Yeah, run with that Abraham Lincoln for a little bit longer. I thought it was funny.
Guys, I don't think that's the real Abraham Lincoln.
No!
I agree wholeheartedly, which is why I liked that Sarah and Giovanni weren't just one-time jokes. Like, that Sarah Silverman is in this entire movie and she's great as the prostitute who's saving herself for her husband but having sex with everybody else. And like, I really thought that was really funny stuff. I mean, there's enough of them, don't get me wrong, but I just feel like they could have beefed up other roles in a similar fashion. Obviously, my favorite cameo is Ryan Reynolds, because in all of the movies that Seth MacFarlane has directed, which I think is just this and Ted 1 and 2, Ryan Reynolds is on screen for like a second and doesn't say anything in any of those movies. And yep. In this one, like, he's on screen and he's about to talk and someone shoots him, I think, right? That's what happens to him.
Yep.
That's pretty funny. Like, I think that relationship is really weird. But yeah, it would have been cooler if Jamie Foxx showed up at the fair in the middle of the movie instead of in the post-credit scenes or something.
But it would have been even cool if, like, you know, they walk away and he shows up then. You know what I mean? Or he yeah. walks away and then they come up or whatever. You know what I mean? Like, there are ways to do it and not have it be like he doesn't have to talk to them, just have it in the same scene.
My first time seeing this in theaters, I guess I wasn't paying enough attention. I didn't even notice Bill Maher.
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah. I didn't remember he was in it either, and now it's like, how can you forget? He's so just terrible.
I mean, the one thing I like about that, it's, again, like little scene, little moments, but I like that he has the cue cards where they're actually made of wood and like they drop it and like it just like splits in half. Like there's like little details.
Yeah, that feels like a Mel Brooks joke right there. When he's getting it right, it feels like something Mel Brooks would do. And when he's getting it wrong, I'm going to give all the credit to McFarlane, I guess.
Neil Patrick Harris with the mustache stuff, the mustache song, having Amanda Seyfried suck his mustache, like not a metaphor, like not a euphemism, just actually suck his mustache. Like, it's just so weird. And I get that, like, that's the character. I just feel like he's bringing a lot to it that, like, I don't know if the character's necessarily funny, but just his mannerisms and his behavior and, like, the way he's leaning into it is just, it's just wonderful.
Yeah, I really hate the way that he goes out in this movie by just, like, shooting in a hat and you know that whole thing. It was just like, why this? Like, we were doing pretty well with this character and he's very eccentric and bizarre, but like I totally feel it's a good sort of like parody of people of the time who tried to be like sophisticated and dandies but yet weren't, I guess, all like sort of putting on airs and stuff. So he's a great idea for a character, and it just sucks the way that he goes out like that.
Yeah, and they give him that little How I Met Your Mother nod when he's just like challenge accepted. He's got that little Barney Stinson like nod right in the middle there.
Oh, Mike, I also do want to say that we were talking about Bill Maher. We had the Bill Maher on whatever movie that was on with Zach Dazon. We got new rules here, too.
Oh, shit.
Right?
I guess we do.
There we go. New rules. Don't cast yourself in your movie if you're Seth MacFarlane. Oh, so Charlize in this movie is wearing a wig because she shaved her head for Fury Road, which we're getting to in two episodes. So I'm very excited for that. Also of note to you, Mike, Seth MacFarlane wrote a novelization of this movie based on the screenplay, the first book he ever wrote. So, there you go. Third time's
the
mic.
I cannot imagine how that reads. Like, how do some of these jokes play in those... I'm staying far away from that one.
Probably for the best. The scene where Charlize puts a daisy in Clinch's bottom and Liam Neeson's bottom is similar to a classic scene in Carry On Nurse, apparently, where a patient annoys his nurses so bad they insert a daffodil instead of a real rectal thermometer. I get that they're references to things, but it's just...
That's the most obscure... reference no one's ever heard of before. So it just played like an original joke, which I thought was... childish but funny. Like I was like, that's like a nice and like super embarrassing way to be found.
It's just like, I can't leave you like this, and she just picks the flower up, just inserts it very, very, very lovingly and gently.
Right. Yeah. You think she's gonna pull his pants up and she takes even more of his dignity away.
The only other thing is that this shot, again, this is a movie I've only seen once and like I wouldn't remember it, but again, it sort of paints this movie as a love letter to the Old West and to old Westerns, is that the shot of Clinch, Liam Neeson, leaving the front door of Albert's house to search from outside is an homage to an iconic scene at the beginning and end of The Searchers. So I feel like this is a movie that, like, he really, you know, cares about and wants to make good, but, like, I don't know, man.
Doesn't know how all the way? Like, it just feels like no one was saying no. Like, it just feels like a total prequel situation where everyone involved is just like, good idea, George. Like, yes, George. Like, sure. Like, double down on that. Well, yeah, like, let's... And then start contributing worse ideas, you know? Because they're on sort of, like, the bandwagon at that point.
Yep.
He's an auteur, Joey. Like, talk about cinemakers.
Nope.
But he's, like, a poor one. Like, yeah, you know? Like, he's just, like, I feel like he has too much control. Like, if someone were just there to be like, cut him off at certain points and say, you know, reel it back, like, there is definitely stuff here to craft into a good movie. It's just overkill and indulgence that you just can tell he can't help himself at times. Like, either he doesn't want to or he can't help himself. So, whatever it is, I mean, as long as he's having fun, more power to him, but try not to make another movie.
Like, I don't mind that he makes movies. Like, it's fine to make movies. It's just, you know, don't cast yourself.
Yourself, and I also feel like don't try and always please yourself, because that's another thing I feel like this movie's going for, is just he's trying to make himself laugh, and sometimes you have to consider the audience, you know, not just your audience, but like, this is going to be reaching potentially more people, or he's going to be seen by more people than know him from cartoons. It's like, they're going to be able to recognize him now after this movie as Seth MacFarlane and stuff. So like, it's just coming out. Do you really want to come out like this? But I guess it's whatever. Just my final thing, since we're wrapping up here for the movie, all the shit talk about this movie and everything, like, I do love Westerns, so, you know, I wasn't really upset that I had to sit through and watch this again, because even, like, a super terrible Western, like, has its high points, like the scenery for the most part, or just like I like the just general aesthetic of the Old West too, real dust and dirt and everything. But this movie might contain one of my all-time favorite jokes in movies, and it pains me to say that because it's this movie. Every time, I mean, when I first saw this movie, I hit one of those fits where like you can't breathe. But when Neil Patrick Harris has to pay Seth MacFarlane $1 and he takes out a dollar bill, one of the guys hits his son over the head and tells him to take off his hat. That's a dollar bill. Like, I lost my mind. Like, I just, in this time too, like, I laughed extremely hard every time that comes up. And I just think that's one of the greatest jokes. I don't know exactly why. I mean, I guess just because it was a dollar was a lot back in 1800s, you know? So, like, it's just really funny how overblown that was. They'd never seen a dollar before.
I mean, there's a lot of funny in this movie. It just feels long, and there's just a lot of stuff that isn't funny. I don't know. It's just, it's disappointing. But there is a lot to like in this, and I can absolutely see, like, if this works for you, like, if you can buy into his character, I can absolutely see why, like, why people could love this movie. You know what I mean?
I think anybody who's a fan of just raunchy, his style comedy, I could see this actually pleasing a lot of people who are just ravenous Seth MacFarlane fans. And there are, I do meet a lot of people that, you know, they could watch the same episode of Family Guy over and over again because, you know, it's funny to them. And I think for those people, they would probably really, really like this movie.
Do you think, did people see it? Was this movie successful?
I don't know. I don't remember hearing much about it. But I agree with Duke there. Like, I definitely feel like he has his fan base, and this is catering to them, and they probably just have the same type of sense of humor as him. And I mean, I feel like his base probably loved this stuff, and I guess people like us who are just a little more, like, I approached it more as a Western and less as, like, a Seth MacFarlane comedy, that it just ended up disappointing on that level for me.
Like, you can see the nods. Like, I bet the Back to the Future reference blew those folks, like, absolutely away.
Yeah. Yeah, and especially, what was this, only like 4 or 5 years ago? It just makes me laugh so much how hard he probably had to fight to get that reference in, and in Zombieland with Ghostbusters, and then now we have, you know, movies like Ready Player One, where it's like the more the merrier and stuff. And so it's, I wonder if like that might have contributed in a way to be like, look, like the public loves this kind of thing. They want these callbacks to like Back to the Future and all this stuff. So like, let's get it back out there. Like, originally, I didn't like that he opens a door and Doc Brown's there, because technically, I think it's like 2 or 3 years after Marty shows back up and stuff.
Mike, just to let you know, I will pick this apart. So it does kind of aggravate me, because you got to remember the whole trilogy took place in the fictional town of Hill Valley, California, in 1885, and we've established in the very first scene of this movie that Old Stump or Little Stump or whatever the town is called is a town in Arizona, and it's 1882. So, not to be that guy, but this reference completely is inaccurate to where Back to the Future would fall.
Hear, hear.
I'm sorry.
No, don't be sorry. You might have to be on my episode of Back to the Future 3 for third times. I might have to get you in there.
That would make me very happy.
This movie cost $40 million to make. In the U.S., made $43 million, so, you know, $40 million probably doesn't count the marketing budget, because I think this movie was plastered everywhere, and then made another $44 million worldwide, which sort of surprised me, but I guess, you know, Family Guy is popular everywhere, you know what I mean? So it made $87 million total on $40 million, so when you factor in marketing, probably didn't make a ton of money, but, you know, it is what it is.
At least it wasn't a flop.
Right. Okay, so any other thoughts about A Million Ways to Die in the West, or can we move on?
No.
I'm good.
Duke, we have a new game since the last time you joined us. We have, this is going to be good. we call it Unfortunate Improv, because nobody really asked for this. We are going to take Charlize Theron's character from this movie, or, if that doesn't work, Charlize Theron as an actress, and we're going to put it out in the, in the big movie or movies of the weekend this comes out. So this episode comes out this Friday, August 10th, okay? There are three big movies coming out that we would like to put Charlize Theron as Annie, is her name, I think?
Oh, in the this movie. Movie, her name?
Yeah, I think. Oh. Is it?
Anna.
Mike and Duke, and myself. How would we put Anna, or just Charlize Theron if Anna doesn't work, in one of these three movies? The Meg, which is the Jason Statham versus 70-foot shark.
Which is directed by Turtle Taub, a Cage Club director.
Yeah, John Turtle Taub of the National Treasure movies, absolutely. So that's number one. Number two, Slender Man, based on the creepypasta, or number three, the Spike Lee joint, Black Klansman, which sort of feels like it could work here with the Django stuff a little bit. So,
is Black Klansman a comedy, or is it...
It's a biography comedy crime drama.
By Spike
Lee. It's where a black guy gets to infiltrate the KKK because he just, like, convinces him on the phone. I don't know. I saw part of a commercial or something.
I think Adam Driver is also in on it, too. Like, he is also a police officer that goes undercover for... So one plays the voice on the phone, and one plays the body in person.
Oh, I could totally watch that.
Yeah, John David Washington, who is from Ballers, is the star. And then Laura Harrier, who is Liz in Spider-Man Homecoming, the girl who's not MJ, is in it. And then Topher Grace, also, who seems to be popping up a lot on what we're talking about lately, Mike. But
all right. I could take the totally simple road right here.
Go for it.
All right, so you've got Doc Brown in the time machine. Charlize Theron stumbles upon Anna, stumbles upon the time machine, and decides that not only is she going to go into the future, but she's also going to show up at whatever, because she had never seen a beach before. Like, she's known the desert her whole life. She's never been to the beach. She wants to go. So she goes to the beach and meets Jason Statham, and she's trying to convince him that she's, you know, not somebody from the past. There's all these subtle hints about her being from the Old West, but, like, she pretty well adjusted since she's versatile, intelligent woman. Sure. And then, of course, this huge freaking shark shows up, and she has to help Jason Statham shoot and kill it, which helps because, you know, she's really, really good at shooting, but, like, everyone's always insisting, oh, why do you like all these stick shooters? And she's like, oh, it's just what I'm comfortable with. And there could be a lot of little subtle things. And when, you know, like, they find out that she's from the past, there could be, like, some kind of a lover's quarrel or something. So, yeah, that could work.
I like that a lot.
Very smart using the time machine there to get her character out of there.
Love it. All right, Mike. How would you put her, since, let's not try to do the Meg, Slenderman or Black Klansman?
Okay, I don't really know what the hell a Slenderman is. I think I'm too old. I just remember hearing that a couple girls got in trouble for stabbing another girl over it at one point.
So Mike, Slenderman, he's like a ghost-like manipulator of people, like the idea being that like if you don't want him to kill you, you should join him. I think that's kind of like the thing. It's from a video game.
Okay. Oh, okay.
So, Mike, do you watch X-Files? Did you watch the new X-Files episodes?
No, I haven't seen new X-Files.
Oh, because there was an episode where they basically did Slenderman a way. But okay, so if you didn't see that, that's not gonna help
you. Okay. Well, I'm gonna go off of my limited knowledge of Slenderman. I'm gonna still go with Slenderman.
Okay.
And because here's my idea is that after A Million Ways to Die in the West, Seth and Charlize, you know, kind of ride off into the sunset, live a long life together. But unfortunately, they come across some hard times, and they end up having to, like, pull a job, and they rob this person who is, like, sort of like an evil practicer of the dark arts and stuff. So what happens is, back in, like, the 1800s, Charlize and Seth get cursed. Seth turns into the Slender Man and starts haunting things for evil. And she turns into the Slender Woman and has to, like, battle him on, like, the astral plane for all eternity. And so, like, they're pitted against each other. And now Slender Man is breaking through to our timeline and our reality. And I haven't seen the movie yet, but if I were writing it, Slender Woman not far behind, trying to track him down and keep him from hurting other people. So
love it.
That's what I got.
I like it.
Love it. Oh, God, that leaves me with Black Klansman. Okay, this won't be problematic. The logline for Black Klansman is Ron Stallworth, an African-American police officer from Colorado, successfully managed to infiltrate the local Ku Klux Klan and become the head of the local chapter. So, okay. Oh, God. You gotta use Jamie Foxx's Django in here because this movie is so white otherwise. Okay. I don't even want to Google when this started because I don't want to search for it. But, like, let's just say the KKK was around in 1882. It might have been, it might not have been, I don't know.
Yeah, they're in Django, like the...
scene? Like Jonah Hill.
Yeah, they're just starting up or something, but yeah.
This is going to be the prequel to this movie, which I think is based on a real story, Black Klansman. But Charlize Theron goes back to the fair, like after the movie ends, she and Seth MacFarlane are in a happy relationship, apparently. They go back to the fair, and they go back to the shooting range because that's where, like, you know, she wants to win prizes because he is obsessed with that duck that he won her and wants to get a lot more ducks or whatever. And she meets up there with Jamie Foxx as Django because they're both, like, these, like, wild shooting whatever. They become fast friends because they're both, like, these badass outlaws, and now that Clinch is dead, they're both, like, the quickest draws in the West. They find out that, like the KKK rolls into town, and Jamie Foxx is like, uh-oh. Then Charlize and he team up in a way to infiltrate the KKK and take it down from the inside. So it's not like he's become the head of the local chapter. They're just getting together to team up to bring it down, sort of kind of like the opening scene in Bad Boys 2.
Yes. Yes, that's great.
So it's, I don't know what the plot is because I don't want to get too in detail, but I do like a world in which Charlize and Django team up because they're both badass sharpshooters, or you know what I mean? Quick draws.
Totally.
So there we go. So okay. Phew, I think I sort of maybe dodged a bullet there, but you know.
Pun intended, right?
Yeah, pun intended. We have an email address here on the show, watch@cageclub.me. Email us, let us know what you think of the episodes, of the movies. Did you like this movie? Do you like Family Guy? Did you like this movie and you don't like Family Guy? That would be the interesting thing I want to hear about. Let us know. You know, we have, how many more movies we have, Mike? We have.
Not many.
Not including this one. We have 9 more movies. We've got Dark Places, Fury Road, The Huntsman 2, Winter's War, The Last Face, which I know nothing about, Kubo, Atomic Blonde, Fate of the Furious, Gringo, Tully. Aside from The Last Face, which I don't know anything about, and aside from Dark Places, which I don't know anything about other than it was written by Gillian Flynn, who wrote Gone Girl and also Sharp Objects. So this is another one of those in that world, kind of, or that style, maybe. The other 7, you know, I haven't seen Gringo or Tully yet, and I haven't seen The Huntsman yet, but I sort of know what's coming, and, like, I'm excited here. We're gonna end on a high note, I think.
Yeah.
It's not every day that you guys get to watch what I consider to be the greatest action film ever made in that category there. Mm-hmm. I mean, Fury Road is just... It's an absolute masterpiece. I could watch that movie over and over again till the day I die.
And then a couple episodes later, we'll have one of the best animated movies of the last 5 years, if not longer than that. And then we're going to have the worst Fast and the Furious movie. Oh, and also the incredible Atomic Blonde, too. So, you know, there's a lot of good stuff. And then we also have, you know, Jason Reitman, Diablo Cody, Charlize Theron team up again. So we are finally, I think, now that we're past A Million Ways to Die in the West, I'm excited to see movies that I haven't seen, you know, whatever The Last Face is, whatever Dark Places is about. You know, I hope there's more campy fun in Winter's War, but there's good stuff here, so I'm excited. But anyway, email us, watch@cageclub.me. Let us know what you think. We actually do have an email, Mike. It's not really to us. It was copied to us, but Jess Collins, a.k.a. Jess Montez, fan of the Zack Attack, Boyfriend Material, Magic Mike's podcast that I do with Joe, too, emailed both Magic Mike's and Watch to talk about Battle in Seattle, because she ranked our fire-ass titles, and she was also talking about how much she loved the Tatum Tots, which are little news segments about Channing Tatum on that podcast. And she also said, and this is a reference to you, that your guess, Mike, for She's the Man, when we did the guess of like how he's going to dance, fight, strip, and be shirtless, reminded her of the plot for Just One of the Guys from 1985.
Yes, because I think She's the Man is very similar to that movie. So.
Very possible. But she also did like, and this is sort of a little bit of a spoiler for tomorrow's Magic Mike, but it's at the beginning of the episode, so it's not too much of a spoiler. Her favorite fire-ass title for Battle in Seattle was your answer of WTNO instead of WTO. So she liked that a lot. So thank you, Jess, for writing in. I don't even know if Jess listens to this podcast or not. I know she was really far behind on the Joe 2 podcasts. She caught up on a lot of them in the last 2 weeks. But thank you, Jess. If you ever hear this, thank you for writing into both podcasts. We appreciate you. But email us, watch@cageclub.me. Let us know what you think of the movie, of the podcast. You know, we're wrapping up, but it's not going to die, because as long as Charlize is making movies, this will be back. But we still have a handful more of really, really good ones.
Any awards this week?
Awards this week. So first off, so we got to nominate Seth MacFarlane for Worst Male Actor.
Just the worst in general.
No, he's actually not the worst in general, but like in this movie. He's
but let's start from the top. Do we want to nominate this for worst film?
I can't in good conscience because of the dollar joke and a few other jokes that actually work.
Do we want to nominate it for most wildly inconsistent tone?
As in like super not funny and then kind of funny and then super not funny. Yeah, that works.
craziest ending. This is one that we have not done in a while. Craziest ending to a movie that didn't deserve it. I guess not really. Like, the ending makes sense within the story. It's more like the main character doesn't deserve the ending he gets, but that's also reflected on my list of Charlize Theron movies where she plays an unattainable dream girl yet is paired on screen with a guy who does not respect or deserve her, ranked by the Order of the Disparity, which is my list name. In this movie, we got a twofer. She is both Liam Neeson and Seth MacFarlane, neither of whom deserve her. But right now on my list, Mike, I have this ranked fourth behind both Woody Allen movies, and I also have it right behind, just barely behind, The Life and Death of Peter Sellers. I think that's a little bit worse in terms of like how poorly she's treated by the man in that movie. Because really, Seth MacFarlane does not deserve her, but to be fair, he does kind of worship her. You know what I mean? Like, he is, he knows what he has, that she's like this wonderful woman. Yeah.
It's also saying a lot that for the minimal screen time she's in the Peter Sellers movie, she gets treated worse than she is, you know, so like it's crazy how she, that she gets third from that movie, but it's true.
I don't want to nominate this for best or worst role, but I would be okay nominating it for most badass role. I mean, it's not going to beat Furiosa, it's not going to beat Atomic Blonde's role, but like, she's kind of great. She's kind of a badass in this movie.
Yeah, I guess she's still in a bit of that Furiosa mode too, because she's got presence and swagger in this movie that just you don't want to fuck with her. You know, I feel like everybody is sort of taken aback by her appearance in town. They're just like, oh, damn. Like, okay.
Most wasted performance, no. I think she's really good here. This is one we also haven't done in a while, but I think might work. Most extreme manic pixie dream girl. Like, I feel like she is, in a way, like, living that up. Like, hey, Seth MacFarlane, love your life in the West. I'm here to help you. Like, I think it's not quite in the same vein as, hey, my trailer broke down and this is where I live now, or read it in Arrested Development. But I think Anna in this movie is a pretty strong example of the manic pixie old Western dream girl.
If she's like, this is where my horse was shot, so I just decided to like build a cabin.
Basically.
Yeah, I guess ultimately in the old West, like, that wasn't around, so like this is as close you could get, but okay, yeah. I mean, it fits enough of it. I just feel like she'd had to be a little more quirky, but I guess just her being in the old West in general is quirky enough.
Let's see here, what else? Most sexist film, no, because I think it captures the sexism of the time, but I think that the women here are, for the most part, pretty empowered. Like, Sarah Silverman is great as this, like, entrepreneurial prostitute.
Yeah, the men are emasculated throughout the movie way more, I feel.
They address, like, the bustle and, like, the constructs of the time, but they don't, I mean, besides the cliche of Liam Neeson beating his wife in one scene, but, I mean, he hits her, doesn't he?
Probably, yes. I don't remember, but yeah, probably.
So.
He's about to, you know, have his way with her when she hits him with the rock in the head. I think the women characters are mostly empowered.
I think so, too.
Yeah.
I'm going to nominate this for Best Charlize Outfit / Wardrobe, because I think it's, you know, unique to what we've seen here. Worst love story, Anna and what's his name? I don't even know what his name is in this movie.
I mean, they seem to, like, love each other and deserve each other.
All right, fine. I'll leave it there. Do we want to nominate, then, this is another one we haven't done in a while, Mike, Best Love Triangle, Albert, Anna, Clinch.
Oh, okay. That's more along the line.
That's a throwback to my last movie with Reindeer Games. Right.
It's amazing how so much like...
Wait, how do we not have Reindeer Games on Best Love Triangle? Wow, we gotta add that in there.
Yeah.
Retroactively include it.
Okay, so Best Non-Charlize Death. What do we want to not... I feel like you have to nominate
the 12.
Something.
The Ice Block? Do you guys have a favorite? Yeah, I was going to say the Ice Block.
Ice Block is also really graphic.
Yeah, I was going to go with the Ice Block just because it's the one that they draw the most attention to.
Yeah, Duke, what's your favorite death in this movie?
I mean, the Ice Block, I mean, just because I remember seeing it from, what do you call it, the trailers came out. But I mean, the other thing that's pretty graphic, I mean, when the camera explodes and the camera guy obviously is like just immediately bursts into flames. But like the two people getting their picture taken are on fire. And so like the two guys sitting there with guns just shoot them because they're on fire.
Right.
But yeah, I'll say the ice block.
And again, it's too bad that the ice block wins, because there's so many more opportunities, you know, for like Looney Tunes types of deaths in this movie.
I am going to nominate, even though I don't necessarily, you know, I just think that her delivery is so good, for best line, oh my god, I love you, I'm like the luckiest girl in the history of girls. I just really like the way that she delivers that, so I'm going to nominate that there. Best freak out, she's really freak out. Best cinematography, I'm going to put this here because it looks beautiful.
Hell Yes.
Best score soundtrack. I'll also do that here because it's great. Like, a great score.
It's insane. Like, they belong. Like, this score, I hope someone else uses it for something else because.
Everything aside from the mustache song.
Should we nominate the mustache song for best song?
Oh, man. I mean, it's not a great song, but it definitely gets stuck in your head. I was humming it this morning, making coffee.
All right, so yeah. The mustache song.
Coffee. Put the water in the thing. Like, I was just.
Conversely or similarly, do we want to nominate the mustache dance for best dance scene?
You know what I quite like about that dance scene is that at first it starts off as like this couple's kind of dance, but at the end it turns into like a West Side Stories type of dance against Seth MacFarlane, and it's almost like a dance battle at that point.
Although Charlize is not involved, right? She's just on the sideline.
Yeah, she is at first when everyone's dancing like normal, but then somewhere in the middle of the song it shifts into like a dance battle thing. I mean it's no Beach Street, but like I always appreciate the effort for a dance battle.
Best non-Charlize male or female. Anybody we want to nominate for best in this movie?
Giovanni comes close. I mean, like, he's just doing a great performance of that character, is great and stuff, but I mean, he's not central enough.
Right.
Really. I don't, because Seth doesn't let anyone else take the spotlight long enough.
Right. Sort of, you know, considered. I would, if we had the category that Tobin recommended or suggested back on the, you know, North Country or whatever other episode he was on back then, if we had best on-screen couple, I would nominate Giovanni Ribisi and Sarah Silverman here, just because they're so weird and unique. But again, that doesn't really necessarily have a lot to do with Charlize. We've got to pare these down anyway, so I'll skip that. Worst actor, worst male actor slash role, Seth MacFarlane.
Sorry, dude. I like him as Ted, the teddy bear. Like, I actually quite like Ted 1, and Ted 2 has its moments as well.
So, yeah, so that's it. So anything else about this movie that we want to nominate, good or bad? Because I think we've nominated now for 12 things, which is... wow, that's a lot. Most wildly inconsistent tone, most badass role, most extreme manic pixie dream girl, best outfit wardrobe, best love triangle, best non-Charlize death, best line, best cinematography, best song, best score, best dance scene, worst male actor slash role. So, like, a lot, but I think it also sort of deserves a lot of that. So,
yeah.
Anything else, good or bad, or are we sort of good to wrap up here on... this episode of Watch the Throne.
I am good to go.
That's a wrap.
Well, thank you so much, Duke, for joining us on this episode. I do want to point out, that's nothing to do with Duke, this is just a terrible transition, that 2 days ago, we released the first episode of Kyle Reinfried's Foodie Films, so Ooh. Go check that out. I think we might have mentioned that either a week or two ago, but he was on our Mighty Joe Young episode, so go check that out. He is talking about, I believe, Julie and Julia in the first episode, and then come back next.
Julia Child.
There you go. And then next Wednesday, so like in 5 days from now, I will be on talking about Butter.
Sweet.
So go do that. But yeah, so go check out Foodie Films. Brand new. It's the newest show on the Cage Club Podcast Network. Go
I'll
do that.
I'll be on an episode of Soylent Green.
Yes, I heard about that. So that's very exciting. Where the special ingredient is people. Spoiler alert, but everybody knows that. Also, Mike and I, since last time we recorded, decided to not only do one podcast next, but I think we're going to sort of go out with a bang, maybe. Again, I keep saying this is going to be the last one we do. Who knows? It just feels like it might be. But instead of just doing one new podcast when this wraps up, we're going to do two. So we will announce those by the time this podcast ends. We already know what we're going to do. I just don't want to get too far ahead of ourselves because they're not going to happen for 6 months or so.
And last time that happened, it was Mr. Affleck, so...
I also do feel like the person that we're doing this about, like, we already kind of know the bad stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Can we
get a
worse.
Hint? Very vague.
It's a male. I referenced one of his movies earlier in this show.
We're targeting right now, just to keep it on a Friday release, and loving to release in the first of the month for the first episode, maybe Feb 1 might be the first episode, so a little under 6 months from now, but we'll see, because this is going to go, Charlize is going to go, Watch the Throne will go until the beginning of November-ish, so a little bit of time off, maybe do a Cinemakers run, who knows, but starting up in about 6 months, two different podcasts, maybe three, but probably two. Go to cageclub.me, just keep your eyes peeled there. Oh, also, go to cageclub.me/newsletter. I might tease things in the newsletter.
Oh, yeah.
Because if people care enough to get our newsletter every month, cageclub.me/newsletter, I might just spoil or hint at what's coming up, because that's cool.
Cool if you posted, like, a part of a picture and be like,
ooh, yeah, like a little,
what
yeah.
What is this? Mm-hmm, who is this mm-hmm. person? Can you guess what this is?
Yeah. So go to cageclub.me, facebook.com/cageclub, at cageclubpod on Twitter and Instagram. Email us, watch@cageclub.me. And also, check out cageclub.me/newsletter. Get that in your inbox the first of the month, every month, and sort of be in the know of what great has happened and what's going to come up. So you might just know what's happening in the future. So I'm Joey Lewandowski.
And I'm Mike Manzi.
And that was Dan the Duke Hayden. And we'll see you next time, next week, for Dark Places on Watch the Throne.
You men who long for love, you mustn't all despair. There's a secret you should know to capture the hearts of the fair. You may not have the looks, you may not have the dash, but you'll win yourself a girl if you've only got a mustache. A mustache, a mustache, if you've only got a mustache.